Now, we've got a book for you, published by O'Brien Press. It's called Swimming Upstream, and they say it's a remarkable new book, part memoir, part call to action. This is the story of Limerick man Patsy Perrell's lifelong mission to save the Atlantic wild salmon, an inspiring journey filled with hope and practical solutions to save his species from extinction and help protect our precious rivers and waters. Well, our fishery scientist Ken Whelan knows a thing or two about salmon and Patsy Perrell.
Yeah, it's a fantastic book. It's written by a chap I've known for many, many decades. He's a real advocate for the wild Atlantic salmons, and that's Patsy Perrell. And I must say, it's really well co-written by Deirdre Nuttall. And Deirdre has a really strong reputation for working with experts and people who are passionate about particular subjects and really putting a lovely writer's gloss on the English. And I must say that the research in terms of the detail in relation to times, in relation to factual information, as far as I can see, is absolutely spot on. But back to Patsy, because Patsy's from a tiny little village, or what was a tiny little village, on the banks of the Shannon, just outside of Limerick, a little village called Cuna, which certainly when he was growing up was quite isolated from the city itself. But the little village was basically built around fishing, and particularly fishing for the great big salmon that ran up the Shannon. And the Shannon was really famous because of the fact that it had these absolutely enormous salmon, some of them 30 to 40 pound weight. And Patsy recounts in the book the history of the fishing in this area and then the advent of the Ardnacrisha Dam just upstream of that and his adventures then in terms of going abroad indeed to try and save the wild Atlantic salmon on an international basis. Mm-hmm. It covers literally everything. It covers the actual Shannon itself. It covers the salmon in the Shannon. It covers issues in relation to, say, for example, drops in water quality over time in the Shannon. It looks and talks about all of the features of the salmon that gave Patsy an interest then in looking broader into the whole area of wildlife conservation. And strangely, and I think really very, very neatly explained in the book, Patsy then became a champion for seals, which you might think is a complete contradiction because very often we hear about conflict between fishermen and seals, but he's a very level-headed view of seals. And he goes on to then explain in great detail about the politics of the salmon. The politics of the salmon is really fraught. It's a very difficult and very, very challenging area.
So we're not getting into that
We certainly won't be dealing with that. But what I'd like to encourage people to read the book for is for them to get a feel for just how this exposure to this one single creature imbued in Patsy this absolute love of wildlife and this total commitment to actually moving forward and looking at conservation in the round. It has human life, it has fish life, it has wildlife. I think it has everything that our listeners would really be interested in. And it all begins in the small little village of Cuna, where he grew up and where he lives today.
In a sense, it was a naval village by the fact that the English system used to be for several hundred years, apart from the impressment of their navy members, that anybody who was a fisherman or able to handle a boat was automatically enlisted for service in the British Navy. So we have a nautical tradition here going back into the first time, you know, Henry VIII, pre that even, maybe, like, you know. But we're morphed into the, and you could say, we were almost, actually, a fishing village. And in reality, we were an island before the embankments were built. And the first of those embankments actually happened at Bunratty, and it's supposed to have been Danes that erected those embankments, you know. But we're in reality an island. 90% of the village was dependent on fishing, and agriculture then was 10% of it. And we were under the, what would you say, for most of our time, the past few hundred years, was the baronry of Bunratty had a big say in it, because there was castles here on the island of Cuna, and the castle of Bunratty So would the Kings of Thomond, the Earls of Thomond and all that, you know, were very prominent here.
And as you were growing up with the family, give us an idea of how important the salmon was to the family and just how many fish were about at that time in the Shannon.
The Shannon was alive with fish in the 1920s because it's noted on record up around Carrick-on-Shannon and Drumard and the Boyle and places like that, that the Black and Tans used to be shooting fish from the bridges and sides of the streets of the villages in that area as a pastime. And that's reminiscent of what the actual Romans were doing over in Staines in England.
What caused the big decline, the catastrophic decline indeed, in terms of salmon in the Shannon?
Well, in the Shannon, it's quite simple. The key to when it happened was 1927, when the effect of impounding the river came into play. So from then on, down, same as it came off a cliff. So there was a period for about 2 years in the early 30s when there was only two boats were able to make a living over the river, out of about 15 boats to 20 boats were there at the time, you know. So it was the Shannon, the death knell was electricity. But if we didn't have electricity, the whole country was dead, like, you know. So we had to bite the bullet, as they say.
Yeah, you're very fair about that in the book in terms of saying there was no doubt about it. At that stage, there was a couple of hundred small private operators that were feeding electricity into just part of the country, mainly into the towns and the cities. But in reality, there was no central generation of electricity. So the only real option really was to tackle the Shannon because you had this huge amount of energy. Correct me if I'm wrong, but in terms of trying to build a picture of this, basically what happened was at a place called Partine on the Shannon, they built a very, very big weir and then divided the river in two. So there was the natural channel coming down one side and then there was this diverted channel that was going down the other side. And that went down to the huge big generators in Ardnacrusha that were generating the electricity. Is that a fair description of what happened?
Yeah, that was it, yeah. And it actually two dams then took effect on the salmon. You know, their migration route was blocked off, totally impounded. And when the powerhouse was built, the one of the on the diverted part of the river, when that came into play, they didn't. That went into production in 1929-ish. And there was no provision made for a pass for salmon on that until 1959, 30 years later, kind of like, you know. That finished off that section, and that's where 90% of the water flow of the Shannon was, which attracted the salmon in there. And salmon died in that location, downriver a couple of hundred yards, for 30 years in their thousands. Then you had the up in Bord Hill, Partine, you know, there's two places called Partine, so geographically it's very confusing for people who are not in the area, because where the powerhouse in Carnacrusha is also called Partine, and you have Partine Weir, which is 10 kilometres upstream on the main river. And that was blocked off so as they could divert the water towards the powerhouse. But there again, the Ben Jacks, that the lifts, they put in a supposed pass, but you had only 5%, 10% of the water coming down there, right? And they couldn't spare the water from the powerhouse to fully activate that pass in O'Brien's Bridge, Bord Hill area. So both sides were blocked off. One was semi, and once in a blue moon would operate for a couple of hours and some couple of fish would get through. But due to the scarcity of water on the main river, it didn't function properly.
In terms then of the drop, which was very obvious to everyone, in terms of the numbers of fish eventually that were coming back, You describe in your book where the ESB then put in place a really huge hatchery. I think they were producing about 200,000 baby salmon, these silver smolts. So what was your view on that? Because did that compensate for what was lost in terms of the natural spawning in the system?
It was a blessing in one sense, but it damned the situation in the word DAM in, you know, in the other, because it was very hard then to isolate which were the wild fish and which were the artificial fish. So there was a huge incentive built up, and that's what led to the overfishing all around the coast, was because of those hatcheries in Cork, the Erne, the Liffey, you name it, like, you know. Everybody thought to bring for a bonanza, but environmentally it wasn't compatible with wild fish runs, and the incentive was produced to catch both cohorts of fish at the one time. So you had the wild fish mixed with the hatchery fish, but over time the wild fish were the lower, were less than 50%, and the hatchery fish were above that. So you had to have a decline in which, you know, exponentially dropped in the opposite sense, right? The wild fish declined rapidly, and because the hatchery fish were being reproduced artificially and they had an infinite number, whereas the ordinary self-producing fish was dependent on nature, and nature couldn't compete with the artificial industrial output by the million. About 80 million smolts were put in up to the present from 1959 into the Shannon system alone, you know. So that's a colossal amount, you know, over the years. So, and they used to give the smolts joyrides down the Shannon, load them up in helicopters and drop them off halfway down, you know. And the misfortunate fish, the smolts, the hatchery ones, some used to come back into Fines Harbour thinking that they were ships, and another bunch were going to Limerick, dry dock, into the dock. And the workers just go home with bags of fish in the evening time, because these smolts, when they were matured and came back, thought they were at home in these square, you know, impounded cages, like, which were concrete, you know.
You witnessed then at first hand, obviously, these very serious problems on one river. And then in your own life, you made a really big jump because, I mean, some people might have just concentrated on their own back door and concentrated on their own issues. But you then got very involved very early with the international scene. You and I have met decades ago. When I was working as a biologist, you were there as an advocate for the wild fish and very articulate advocate. So what actually brought you to the conclusion that you should put your very valuable energy into this fight for the Atlantic salmon on an international basis from your tiny little village in Cúna? What really got you interested in that whole question of overall salmon survival?
It was natural, more or less, to me, like, you know, to be in it, because that's what I wanted to do. And I loved the river, and I loved boats, and I loved the fish. So that's what put me that way. Now, and which brings us, Ken, to, you know, where we often met abroad, yourself and myself. I think that if we have to save salmon, which we do, right, the place to start is where they are being commercially fished at the moment. If we don't halt the commercial fishing of all the European fish, not alone ours, but the English, French, Spanish, wherever, right? You know?
Just to bring you back to where it started as such, you got involved then with the international scene, and you got very involved. And tell us how you got involved with the seal sanctuary, because it seems a real contradiction that a fisherman, and we know down the years that fishermen have had real worries about seals, that a fisherman would suddenly realise that he had a large amount of ideas and a large amount of enthusiasm and energy to devote to actually the lives of seals and the conservation of seals. You might tell us a little bit about your involvement with the seal sanctuary and with Brendan.
Well, it came about because it was starting to take traction. Everybody knew the salmon were in decline back in 1980, and there was a big drive on to cull the seals. The seals were being made a red herring of, blaming them for the demise of the wild salmon. So I knew that to be a lie. You know, I knew that wasn't the truth. So I came out openly and wrote a letter to the Irish Times, which they thankfully printed, and I got introduced to the Irish Seal Sanctuary to take the case further, and they built on that then. And we got a group going together of other like-minded fishermen like myself, and we started to gain traction of what the real situation was. It was a free-for-all at sea because, as I said earlier about the incentive from the hatcheries and the whole lot, that's what kept the sea fishing going, the drift netting. And lots of illegal people came in on the back of that. There were a lot of law-abiding fishermen there, but at the end of the day, they became the minority, and the people who wiped out the salmon in reality were the nits. So I took it for there then, right? I just said, no, I'm not going along with that surmise that it's the seals that's doing it, because I haven't seen any seals going around with 10-mile, 20-mile or 30-mile of monofilament net behind, towing it around, you know, to catch the fish. And a trawler load of salmon, it has been reported that the biggest record of fish that was caught during that period of this law and disorder was 15,000 fish came in on a boat to Burton Port in Donegal back during that period of time. So that's a colossal figure. So the hatcheries were churning out the fish in their millions. And there's no way that seals could be having an effect on those, you know.
The wonderful Patsy Perrell speaking with our own fishery scientist, Ken Whelan.